Well, thank you very much, and we're good to be in this company of other scholars at the Whitsun Institute. It is my maiden voyage to the Institute, and very happy to be here. I have the pleasure to be on campus before the invitation of our study, so actually, for not inviting me sooner, 2 years ago. But that's between us, not between you and me. I made a point at the SALA meeting, Association for the Study of African-American Life and History Conference, a keynote speech a couple of years ago, about the fact that we have, I think, marginalized the fact that African-Americans were in slavery in the 20th century. That's what I'm going to talk about today. I mentioned that I was working on a book, and I submit the book. It is now completed. It's in press at the Third World Press, and it will be out sometime at the beginning of the year. I should say that they told me I would have some flyers for this meeting, and so I'll still continue to hope that they are on the way. Title of the book is Neo-Slavery in the 20th Century, The Forgotten Legacy of the NAACP. Most historians who have written about slavery admit that official slavery was outlawed by the 13th Amendment to the Constitution at that time. But few have pursued the fact of slavery past that date, indeed into the 20th century. Evidence of this is that one of the earliest works on this subject, written by Pete Daniel in his work, The Shadow of Slavery, based upon records of the Puritan system, is a significant exception. But even his revealing research has invited little follow-up by scholars, perhaps because it breaches the canon of the field that marks chattel slavery as somehow markedly different from the system of death slavery and peonage that followed. One of the things I forgot to do is to give you my apology for the fact that I am not a professional historian. This, in fact, is a political scientist parachuting in to a field where he may not belong. So in any case, I did it because of what I just read to you. Daniel cites Carl Schurz, who says that long after slavery was officially declared illegal, former slave masters attempted to maintain the existing relationship between blacks and themselves, of master and slave, both by not telling slaves that they were free and by imposing upon them the same relationship in the new status of employer and employee. Daniels presents a chilling yet measured picture of the fact that while some blacks were able to take relatively immediate advantage of freedom, many languished in an informal slavery which ended only slowly over a period of time. He says, and I quote, because peonage was frequently isolated in the back country, no clear estimate of its extent is possible. A.J. Hoyt, who had spent years investigating white cattle and peonage, estimated that in 1907, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, investigations will prove that 33 1/3% of the planters operating from 5 to 100 plows are holding their cargo, their Negro employees, in the condition of peonage and rearresting and returning those that leave before the indebtedness is paid. Gregory Freeman, another one of the few scholars who have taken up this subject, concluded in the initial lines of the introduction to the book, quote, within all history, there is a lie. The lie told to Southerners and everyone else is that slavery disappeared after the blacks. It did not. Slavery existed well into the 20th century in America in the form of peonage, whereby blacks were fined for vagrancy or other supposed crimes and then forced to work off their debt on local farms, what often became a brutal lifetime condition. For those trapped in peonage, the technical distinction between themselves and the slaves of a previous generation was meaningless, unquote. This conclusion, based on the research of scholars who did not accept the common end of slavery myth, is exaggerated. In this nadir, in the nadir for blacks at the turn of the 20th century, there was cause for whites to rejoice in the growth of the American economy. And the industries coming on stream made it possible for the South to begin the Industrial Revolution. Professor C. Van Woodward estimates that the substantial penetration of Northern capital into the South began in the late 1870s, when Northern and Southern politicians negotiated agreement over their collective political leadership and the withdrawal of Union troops from the South. He suggested that the Northern industrialists focused investment in such areas as real estate, railroads, minerals, timber, iron, cotton, and textiles. Most of these would employ black labor. Indeed, the so-called progressive era was noted for its real attempt at political reforms, but not for its progressive treatment of blacks. Herbert Shapiro looked at this period from the standpoint of the violence visited upon blacks and finds that there is perhaps more violence against blacks on a national level in the progressive era than in any other. As the issue clearly was eliminated with the elimination of blacks, it answers the question of who would rule the South after the Hayes Bargain of 1877. In the seminal study of Reconstruction, Dr. W.B. Du Bois argues that it was the objective of the entire system of Southern jurisprudence and political control to keep black labor poor and to force them into a state of peonage. He reports the views of Assistant Attorney General Charles Russell, who in 1908 expressed no doubt that the state laws intended such. Proof that in the early 20th century, these practices were referred to as slavery, quote unquote, may be found in official government documents. For example, in correspondence between the U.S. Attorney in Alabama and the Justice Department, these practices were referred to in the following terms. A system of enslavement of colored people in Alabama begun, as I stated, in Tuscaloosa County, and has now become a system in many parts of the state, carried on by that class of men who, by the reason of their party prominence in the community, though they exercise influence over juries and public officials, as to make the local courts of their own communities powerless to enforce the law. Negroes, having committed no crime, have been taken by force, carried to this place, shackled, and forced to work under the most brutal treatment without pay for services, where bloodhounds were kept for the purpose to prevent their escape. Other evidence one could marshal that year, and by the way, documents that I've worked from are from the National Archives, but there are literally thousands, hundreds of thousands of other documents at the state level which support the same thing that I'm talking about today. Other evidence that year surfaced, this is 1908, and news accounts of U.S. Secret Service investigations, finding that, I'm quoting, hundreds and perhaps thousands of defenseless and friendless black men have for years been held in a state of slavery, little if any better than slavery that existed before the Civil War, unquote. The investigation found the now unusual practice of a local magistrate charging blacks with petty offenses, finding them a dollar. Because they couldn't pay, they were sentenced to hard labor, sold to a contractor, and paid the fine. Thereafter, they were punished, severe whipping, bodily torture, killing, and not allowed to escape the guard premises. Well, the question raised here is whether those blacks who experienced 20th century slavery, by their own definition, have a right to define their circumstance, or whether or not it should be defined by academics. The following principles, I think, give us some indication. If I cannot leave the place of work, if the master of that work beats me brutally at his pleasure, if he also holds my wife and children to labor, if he kills my friends for any reason, if he pays me little or not at all, If I can be arrested and sent back to the master for any reason, if the legal system does not recognize my loss of freedom, then I have a right to conclude that I am a slave. Doug Blackman, who won the Pulitzer Prize this year for a book, Slavery by Another Name, has the same theme, and we have discussed this. He says, in one place in the book, somebody else I cussed out, because his book won the prize just as I was finishing mine. So I had to go back through mine. So I called him up. We had a wonderful, and we reconnected in the cellar. But in any case, he says that we should rename this era of American history, known as the time of Jim Crow segregation. Then elsewhere in the statement, he concludes the following. Let us define this period of American life plainly and comprehensively. It was the age of neo-slavery. Only by acknowledging the full extent of slavery's grip on U.S. society, its intimate connections to present-day wealth and power, the depth of its injury to millions of black Americans, the shocking namelessness of its true end, can we reconcile the paradoxes of American life. Unquote. The NAACP came into this picture and grew furiously from its inception, not only from the hope of a new generation of African Americans for a new life, but also because of the pain that blacks who had been excluded from life were experiencing in the new taste of freedom, and from the violent repression that many others were experiencing through lynching and labor control in a condition that was repeatedly described in these documents as worse than slavery, quote unquote. In the records of the association may be found numerous letters and other documents attesting to cruelty, such as beatings and restrictions of movement that were so typical of 19th century slavery. Documents blacks working all over the South were writing to the organization as a fledgling organization begging for relief. Some were typical of many of the circumstances that defined the environment, and therefore a substantial part of the agenda of the NAACP would encounter upon its birth, are described in the following brief reference to peonage and slavery in Knoxville, Tennessee. I'm quoting the New York Times article of 1906. After listening to, for a week, tales of peonage and slavery, brutality, and murder, the federal grand jury in session here for the longest period on record today reported indictments against 7 men for peonage. The indictment contained over 25 counts and mentioned some 30 victims who were forcibly restrained of their liberty and compelled to labor in fear of their own lives. Many, many documents like that. The first case that the NAACP had was the Pink Franklin case, a peonage case. And this is why I talk about redoing the legacy of the NAACP, because many people believe that it was only a legal legacy. But it started out with fighting slavery in the 20th century. In Elaine, Arkansas, 1919, militant black farmers, many of those who had just come back from the war, or had organized a union, and they were trying to get their wages, and they were trying to do other things. Well, they were confronted by whites, also with guns, and there was a shootout in Elaine, Arkansas. And the Pink Franklin was one of those. The NAACP was brought into the case, and finally by 1923, Pink Franklin was exonerated. Gilbert Jonas was to say this fact. The legal, political, and financial success of the NAACP during and after the defense of the Phillips County farmers began to demonstrate a strategic point on which in future years the experienced NAACP leaders would certainly build. And that's the point. They really did build on this legacy of fighting for African Americans to get out of 20th century slavery. There were many exemplary cases. I won't go through them for lack of time. I will only talk about the vetting process of the NAACP. As indicated, letters came from a wide variety of sources. When such letters were received, they were often rewritten by the association office to make them intelligible, since the handwriting of many Southern blacks was not sufficient. Many letters were barely readable. The association would often ask the writers for substantiation of the charges in the form of affidavits or eyewitness accounts of other persons. The association would send what it collected to the U.S. Attorney General with a request that they investigate. The Attorney General's office would then pass on the request to the Federal Bureau of Investigation or the district office, and then, of course, they would continue to hound them until they did investigate. And all of this, the NAACP kept up a stream of communication on these cases, also writing back to the victims, their associates, time and time again. Many of the branches that the NAACP initially started by blacks in these conditions. One letter, for example, suggests that the branch consisted of a large number of workers whose motivation was, and I'm quoting, that we Negroes are barely living. After all, we have no one to carry our troubles to, unquote. Then he went on to describe the manner of social control. There was only one white man to every 150 head of colored people on the farm. But the white man is so well organized against the Negro until he can treat him just as he wishes, and there is nothing said. So we, as members of the NAACP, are doing all we can to increase our membership, believing that our only help will come to the NAACP. And then he signed off, quote, "We'll close. I am afraid to say too much," unquote. The National Urban League also was founded, as you know, from your following, the NAACP, and there was some association between the two organizations in some of these cases. The NAACP took the lead. Every now and then, you would have a complaint come through the Urban League. The Urban League would forward it on to the NAACP, and then they would work to follow the cases. Lynching was part of the violence of this period, and lynching was important because our scholars had almost treated lynching as something set apart, something disconnected from 20th century slavery. But we have to understand that the organization began at Mary White Overton with a test in 1908 with a reaction of some progressive whites to mob violence against blacks in Springfield, Illinois. Between 1919 and 1922, 239 blacks were recorded as having been lynched, and the brutality and open horror of the events attracted public outcry. Lynching was used as a public tool to intimidate blacks, and I wouldn't go wrong with that. The NAACP sought to end this practice. The first president of the association, Morfield Story, wrote a brief in support of the Dyer Bill in 1918. Lynching took place in locations where blacks were held against their will, and the violence of lynching was very often related to perceived violations by the plantation owner using a loose association of enforcers, sometimes associated with law enforcement officials, to punish some offense in that context. The NAACP preferred the definition of lynching, and they called it murder sanctioned by the community, unquote, which permitted an opening for the inclusion of the Elaine, Arkansas case. The association had a tremendous relationship eventually with the Justice Department, but it started in this period of when, as we say, they would pass on these cases to the Justice Department and then hound them to be investigated. An attempt to maintain and encourage positive relations with the Justice Department was seen by April 1921, communication between Walter White and Attorney General M. Daughtry. White leads with the sentiment that I'm quoting, "May I express our appreciation for the splendid work being done by the Department of Justice in cleaning up patronage conditions in the South." And then he goes on to inform him of the latest case that he wants him to deal with. Obviously, it had tremendous relations, but the other side of that was that the Justice Department had to be dragged kicking and screaming by the NAACP in the investigation of many of these cases. And that was certainly true when the FBI was formed. The FBI was started around the same time. And none other than Attorney General Charles Bonaparte, who was a nephew of Napoleon Bonaparte III, created the Bureau of Investigation from a corps of 300 special agents. Now, the person who came to be head of this on May 10th, 1924, was J. Edgar Hoover. And so he was present at the inception. And so the NAACP often had to press him because he was head of the investigative division, newly created to investigate many of these PNAS cases. And of course, what we know from history is that he often, very often, refused to do so. So when he refused, then the NAACP had to go to the Attorney General to force J. Edgar Hoover to investigate many of these cases. That wasn't a fact from Charles Houston. In the early 1930s, Walter White called on Charles Houston, then Dean of Howard University Law School, to assist the association's legal committee. Houston took the case of George Crawford, a black person who had been charged with robbery and murder of two socially prominent white women in Middleburg, Virginia. These cases attracted Houston to the association, but he also had to then end up doing peonage work. In 1931, Walter White was still involved in fighting peonage. And in 1937, Houston sent a memorandum to the association newspaper editors pointing out, quote, an alarming increase in peonage cases in the South this year, unquote. So the organization was carrying these two balls involving, on one hand, civil cases having to do with various kinds of discrimination, and on the other, fighting the tremendous backwater of people still in slavery. On the political front, what they did strategically was to begin to involve some of the members of the U.S. Congress in this fight in some of these states. So they didn't just deal with the Attorney General. They would ask some of the members of the legislature to intervene in some of the cases. Sometimes they did, and sometimes they didn't. Sometimes they were successful in getting resolutions passed at the state level, and sometimes city council resolutions. So that was the evolving political strategy of the NAACP in that era. The Roosevelt era was extremely important. We're in the 1940s now. The 1940s, remember? And the census revealed that although 70% of black males were in the labor force, they were clustered in the lower rungs as farmers and farm managers. Boyer Townsend, an official of the CIO, noted that 62% of all blacks were in agriculture, only 29% of white men. And more than half of those blacks in agriculture were in the agricultural sector, was located in the South in the farm tenancy system. That is more than half located in the farm tenancy system. Roy Wilkins observed this data coming out of the census in 1940. He said, the sharecropping system of Southern agriculture has held millions of Negroes and poor whites in virtual economic slavery, impoverishing the entire region as it has impoverished its victims. Roosevelt enacted the Agricultural Adjustment Act, and that paid small farmers not to produce cotton. And that was considered to be a deleterious act because it then pushed many poor black farmers under the bus. Yet peonage was alive during the Roosevelt period. Herbert Aptheker asserts that the most conspicuous case of peonage came to public attention during the late 1930s. A guy named William Cunningham, who ran a farm in Georgia, and he talked about this case as being one of slavery that he investigated. The refusal of legal authorities to prosecute this case was a very interesting phenomenon because it caused a coalition of organizations to begin to come together. The National Negro Congress, the Protective Order of the Elks, the National Baptist Convention, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, and many others to form the Abolition of Peonage Committee. This is in the 1940s. Slavery, the legal status of slavery, was a problem in the 1940s and 50s because peonage had been outlawed in 1857, and yet if people were still being held in slavery, then the question was under what statute would you prosecute them? A Howard University professor in 1950 reviewed the status of civil rights. And he talked about the prevalent practice of peonage in the 1950s. The struggle to define it was carried on There were laws that were proposed, and none of them actually passed. But the use of these statutes to confront a substantial caseload of pleadings by the Justice Department, I had a staff of only 5 people. In comparison, the Interstate Commerce section in the Justice Department had over 300 attorneys. 5 as opposed to 300 in 1950. Well, finally, how long? Pleadings cases were still being prosecuted by the Justice Department in the 1950s. One of the final such prosecutions in 1954 involved the Dial brothers, part of a white family that operated a farm 35 miles from Birmingham, Alabama. And they were found guilty, this is the official charge, of holding Negroes in slavery. A Time magazine report of the incident was as follows. The Dial brothers got their slaves from jails. They paid Negroes fines, drove them home to work on Dial farms near Boyd, Alabama, kept them there by force. Fred Dial beat one with a lariat. Soon thereafter, a man died of pneumonia. When the slave's mother got possession of his body, she saw the cuts and bruises on it, asked her white employer for help. He told her that the FBI authorities would, but they did not. The implications of this work, 3 very quick sentences. One is that it has to do, I think, with the issue of those people who have done a lot of work on reparations. If it is true that African Americans were in slavery in the 20th century, and what that does is to complicate the legal arguments of standing and the questions having to do with time that had been used against those people who were bringing suits for reparations. Secondly, it has a lot to do, I think, with the issue of public policy. We have allowed, I think, people to mystify the reasons why African Americans are still poor. And one of those reasons, of course, is that we have not been able to convey the ferocious struggle that was put up to keep them in poverty, and including the fact that many indeed were in slavery all the way up until the 1950s. We don't hear that story. We don't advocate that. And we certainly don't put it into our public policy as one of the rationales why African Americans, so many, even today, are still poor. Slavery, as W.B. Du Bois said, made paupers. And then finally, it's simply a question of correcting history. One of the things that Doug and I talked about is that I'm a political scientist, and he's a journalist, the head of the Wall Street Journal Bureau of Atlanta. And why would we have to tell this story? Well, it's because it's not in common currency. And many of our historians have, I don't know why, I think that they've considered peonage, sharecropping, and these things as the nice form of slavery. And they've not dug down to get the story of the people themselves. Well, we're trying to get down to the people of the story themselves. And so it complicates things like Juneteenth. You know, I don't celebrate Juneteenth because that was the time that some people got the word. But some people didn't get the word until actually the civil rights movement was going on. There were pockets of African Americans in slavery when the civil rights movement was going on. So I think we have to correct that history. And I'm hopeful that the Carter Institute will play a major role in that respect. Thank you very much.